Today's program has been brought to you by Artisanal Imports, an importer of specialty beers from England, Germany, Belgium, and beyond. For more information, visit artisanalimports.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today, I'm joined by butcher Carrie Underley, a third-generation butcher, founder of Range, and author of the James Beard-nominated book, The Art of Beef Cutting. Carrie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You are quite the lady. You've got a very impressive story. And I'd love to just straight out of the gate, tell me how you became a butcher in the first place.
Well, I was born into it. I'm a third generation on both sides of my family. So it was just something that I was always around. And when I needed to get resourceful about work, I just tapped into what was around me. So that's kind of how I got, that was my influence, was being around it as a kid. And then realizing that as I was looking for work, it was a pretty decent trade.
So you apprenticed for 3 years, which is no small feat. And tell me about that experience, and what was a moment when you kind of became surprised and learned something or experienced something that you were like, oh, I had no idea that this was part of this.
Yeah. Well, I got into it because, you know, it was the highest paid job. And so it's like, well, I wanted to do this. But, you know, it was a bit of a challenge to, you know, kind of break through, because not many girls wanted to do it. And being around it, I didn't realize it was different. I mean, both of my grandmothers were butchers, so it was just normal. But getting into it, I think what's really interesting is just having that kind of that tactile experience, being able to kind of connect all the pieces. And until you can really have the time to put your hands on some meat, then you can really kind of connect with it. So that was kind of my moment where I was just like, wow, I could finally put the cuts that I knew together once I really understood how to butcher and understand anatomy.
It seems like being a surgeon of sorts. And
right.
I mean, you know, it's you have to understand the animal in this really unique way. And when we think about butchers, I mean, most often it seems as though it's a very male-dominated culture. And, you know, for you, do you feel like women have any different approaches or any different styles due to physical features? Or, you know, how do you feel you cut, I guess?
Well, the first thing is, you know, especially when you're working with beef, I mean, a side of beef is very heavy. And quarters of beef are usually around, you know, 300 pounds. So first of all, depending on the woman's strength, you have to get a little creative on how to just maneuver the piece of meat and protect your body and, you know, make sure you don't injure yourself. So where a man might be able just to hoist a hind quarter on his shoulder and plop it down, you know, a woman might have to get a cart and get creative with it. But it's also just using your knowledge to your advantage. You know, you don't have to cut it just the way a man does. I mean, you can apply different techniques, cut it in smaller pieces. And I find that in my journey that a lot of women tend to have more of kind of finesse with their hands. So they do a lot of finishing cuts, seems to be a little more nurtured, you know, where sometimes I've noticed that my male counterparts are more about production and getting a lot done, where sometimes the women are more about making sure it looks really nice and that your mom would want to take it home. So, and I mean, there are a lot of great men butchers as well. I'm not saying that. It's just that, you know, it gives them an opportunity to kind of finesse the cuts.
I think of New York butchers like Adam Tiberio, who uses a hook to cut, and then there's, you know, Ryan Farr in San Francisco, who does table cutting. What is your style? How do you cut?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of both. If I can definitely pull on a rail, I will. I'll use that to my advantage. Mainly because I've done a lot of research in trying to identify new cuts out of underutilized subprimals, so things from the chuck and the round, because everybody likes T-bones and tenderloins, but we've got to sell the whole thing. I'm a cross, so I do a lot of seam butchery stuff on the table as well. When you're doing like whole animal, the weight of the animal on the table sometimes is, for a woman, is a bit of a challenge, because you got to continually lift it up. And so if you can incorporate a little bit of both, if you do have a little bit of a rail system, like I said, then you can use both. But primarily, I'm more of probably similar to Ryan, you know, doing a lot of seam butchery, really trying to maximize the muscle's characteristics for the cooking application. So you have to think like a chef and cut like a butcher. So you just can't, you know, cut it end to end one way. You really have to think about how you're going to use this piece of meat and make sure you can maximize those pieces. And so for me, it's more the seam butchery gives me that flexibility to, you know, get more eating experiences out there.
Do you have Icy Hot laying around? Because good God, I'm just so impressed with, I would be exhausted every day at work.
It is exhausted, but oddly enough, my hands never get cold. So I tell everybody, see, it was meant to be. It's in my genes.
Well, so you have a really wonderful book. It's called The Art of Beef Cutting, and it was nominated for a James Beard Award in 2012, which is no small feat. And, you know, what brought you to want to write the book, and what is the book all about?
You know, I don't proclaim to be anything like a Julia Child, but one thing I noticed was just that when she went to France, she realized that this information just wasn't documented. And so as I was going out teaching people about how to cut and harvest out the flat iron steak, I could tell, you know, 10 years ago that people were just hungry for more meat knowledge. And I thought, you know, there's a real opportunity here just to capture every single thing that I know from being a retailer and a researcher and an educator and putting it all in one book. So that was one thing that I noticed, and it was just an opportunity. And I never thought in a million years it would be nominated for James Beard or IACP. I just really thought that there was a need for people to have information to learn, because I was seeing this butchery swell was coming. You know, I knew that as people wanted to go back to whole animal butchery, that this knowledge gap was devoid in how we produce our products today. And so bringing back the butcher, people just need, you know, kind of a guide or a document to help them figure that beast out.
What is range?
Range is kind of the culmination of my consultancy. So not only do I do training and education, but we also do meat marketing, and we do things like meat photography. So we'll shoot, do a photo shoots. A lot of the, like if you've ever seen a cut chart poster that says Beef Made Easy on it, we created that here. So everything very meaty and very educated, focused, just trying to keep a good message out there.
One of the things that I think is really amazing about you is you helped to develop the Denver cut and the flat iron, which is one of my favorite cuts, if I do say so myself. And
hey,
I mean, you know, it's like you go into the grocery store, and we're also accustomed to these really specific cuts that are sort of part of our language, and we never think about how those came to be. So how would you describe how you created the flat iron in the first place?
Well, it wasn't just me. It was a group of scientists to begin with that, you know, like I said, we all like T-bones. And so we had to focus on new uses outside of braising or pot roasting for something from the chuck of the round. And so these researchers did this study called muscle profiling, and they analyzed these muscles for attributes that, you know, new product developer people can use. So tenderness, flavor, water holding capacity. It goes on and on. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds there, but... And so once those data were available, then we had the proof to say, yes, the flat iron steak is the second most tender muscle, and here's the science to prove it. And then where I came in is teaching and developing the cutting methods on how to seam out, getting that flat iron into its form. So Mother Nature's not always kind. Yes, it's the second most tender muscle, but there's a tendon that runs through the middle of it, and so you have to go in and fillet it out. And so that's where me and Range came in and helped develop that. And so with the success of the flat iron, then they said, hey, let's take a look at the chuck roll area, which is still in the chuck, the front portion, and let's look at some of those other cuts. And the Denver cut is actually the fourth most tender muscle in the beef animal. But these are items that we would typically just put in a pot all day and braise it and have barbecue or pot roast with it. And so we're able to identify those characteristics, so that way we could come up with the proper cutting techniques and identify which muscles would be useful to sell at the grocery or on the menu.
What kind of, I'd love for you to tell the story of how a newer cut can get into sort of the large grocery store chain or larger meat markets, so to speak. I mean, I think about, this probably isn't technically a cut, but sometimes they like to make a sirloin like heart shape at the grocery store. It seems to be very popular these days. But, you know, it's like, how do you train butchers within, you know, very common grocery stores across America? How do you train them to, you know, become accustomed to these cuts?
It's a challenge. I think the larger the grocery chain you're working with, the larger of a challenge it is, just from implementation. You know, you've got so many more people to train. So it's usually the smaller regional grocery chains that pick up new cuts first, just because they don't have the implementation barriers to get over. But we would literally go into grocery stores and do hands-on training and work with the folks, do train the trainer type activities. But the other thing that you have to do when you're selling in a new cut is be able to show the economics behind it. You know, you can create a cut, but if your yield is so low, meaning there's not enough product to sell, then it's not advantageous for somebody to put it in their store or place it on the menu. So you have to make sure, so for the new product developers out there that are, we've got this, you know, great cut, you know, make sure that it can be profitable and that it's easy to recreate. And then as far as getting stuff named and getting it picked up in mainstream, it's just, it has to be something that gets repeated. And like the USDA has certain nomenclature and ways to get products, you know, in the door, and it has to have steam in the industry. So it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do. But and test it and make sure it lives up to its performance. So, you know, make sure that if it's good and tasty, that, you know, it can hold up to that steak experience.
One of my favorite regional butchering cultures, if you will, is in, you know, Cajun Louisiana. Cajun meat markets have all kinds of cuts you can't find anywhere else. And, you know, unless you know what the recipe is, 9 out of 10 times, you're not going to know how to properly cook it. And, you know, it's sort of the same concept as you were saying about, you know, the economics of the cut and a lot of braising and getting a lot of flavor out of it. But for you right now, what do you feel is an underrepresented cut that you love? Or it doesn't even have to be, you know, cow. It can be anything.
Yeah, actually, it's out of the ribeye. And mine is, and to me, this is one of the most underutilized cuts because, for example, if somebody has prime rib, so at the holiday, and, you know, a prime rib's that large roast, and it has kind of that fat kernel in the middle, and then there's this ridge of meat that lays on the top. Or if you have a ribeye steak, and if you've ever looked at the meat counter, and you'll see a ribeye steak, and you'll have that thin piece of meat, and then there's a little fat kernel, and a lot of times meat cutters will push it out, you know, so there's just this hole, and that drives me crazy. But, and what people don't like about the ribeye is all the fat. So what I like to do is seam off that whole ribeye cap right off the top, and that's the third most tender muscle. It, especially if it's a prime grade, which is has the most intramuscular fat, so prime being one, then going down to choice and select, it is like beef butter. And to me, that is the most underutilized cut in the whole carcass because we just cross-cut it right with the ribeye, and we don't add any value. And by taking that off, then we can reduce the fat that's inside the ribeye, which I know that's what a lot of people like, and I know some people are probably holding their their head and shaking their hands here, or shaking their head. But being able to do that, then you create a nice ribeye cap. You can butterfly that out. You can roll it. You could stuff it, whatever you'd like, you know, sun-dried tomato and feta and spinach is quick and easy. That's delightful. But then you can make ribeye fillets out of the rest of the ribeye. And so it just gives you that lean ribeye experience without all the fat.
Beef butter. Ruminate on that for a minute. We are going to take a very quick break, but when we get back, lots more from Carrie Underley. You're listening to Yook Hungry. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Kenny Rolls One by Faulty DL on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Artisanal Imports is an importer of specialty beers from England, Germany, Belgium, and beyond. Their portfolio of fine ales and lagers is broad and represents a wide range of beer styles, but it is not their mission to collect every small brewery across Europe. They believe in working in full partnership with their breweries and are careful to select beers that are high quality and interesting, but that do not overlap one to the next. For more information, visit www.artisanalimports.com.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by the all-around amazing butcher, Carrie Underley. Carrie, are you still there?
I sure am.
And, yeah, before the break, we were talking about lots of things, but I'm still thinking about beef butter, because that sounds great. And, you know, looking at the current landscape of the American meat culture, if you will, what types of topics do you think are kind of currently on the table that are being discussed? And at the same time, what topics do you feel are being underrepresented?
I think, you know, right now, as far, especially in larger metropolitan areas, the move to buy local meats, I think, is really on the rise. And one thing I think that's interesting to me about that is people right away when they make, some people make their decision, if it's local, that's their first checkbox. And then sometimes quality and taste isn't what you would expect. So, you know, just as you're going out there looking to buy local products, you know, make sure that, you know, it has that eating experience that you want. I think when a lot of people make a shift and make a decision to buy, like, a grass-fed beef product, they still have that eating expectation of, like, corn-fed beef, you know, that that richer, fattier flavor. So, you know, I think folks have to realize that, you know, a grass, I mean, all cows are grass-fed, but they're, when they're finished on pasture, that you just have to realize that it's going to be more like a gamey kind of experience. So other trends I think people are talking about is, you know, kind of the wave of the butcher, you know, trying to keep that, that trade going. And also just, you know, labeling. I think people want to be clear on their labeling. The lean textured beef thing that came out with the pink slime, everything that broke out, I mean, it was really a labeling issue. And I think, you know, a lot of times consumers just want to know. And then they can make those decisions on whether or not they choose, you know, the GMOs or non-GMOs and corn or things like that. It's really just informing the consumer and making sure it's labeled. So, and to me, that just seems so easy, you know, just inform the consumer. But even that seems to be a bit of a challenge.
So a few years ago, Kim Severinsen of the New York Times wrote a piece that I'm sure you're very familiar with about rock star butchers, which has some interesting perspectives and opinions. And, you know, I've had Adam Tiberio on my show before, and I asked him the same question. One, do you think butchers are rock stars? And two, where are we now? Do we still feel like, you know, the amount of butchers is rising? Are we sort of, you know, at a steady pace, or where are
we? Well, first of all, butchers don't get paid like rock stars, so let's keep that in check. You know, I struggle a little bit with the rock star status. You know, I really like that it brings attention to a trade. You know, my dad hated being called a butcher because that had like a negative connotation. He was a meat cutter; that was prideful. And, you know, society kind of put him in that box. And now, today, we want those craftsmen, you know, and women. You know, we want somebody that knows how to do that. So, you know, in one aspect, I like that it's bringing up the forefront. But we also have a large, large void in our butchery world, if you will. And one of my passions and that I'm working on now is to figure out a way to open up a trade school here in Chicago. So, you know, being able to teach these folks and give them the discipline, the time, and, you know, the knife skills to do it, along with understanding the business of it. You know, I hear so many of these young butchers saying that they're getting into it, and but they can't make money. Well, that does the whole food channel a disservice, because if you're not making money, then you're not pricing your product high enough, and the consumer has a contorted idea of what the value of those products really are. So, you know, teaching them how to understand the math and be successful business owners, I think, is very important. So, you know, I'm excited that, you know, the skill is back. We need trade. We need jobs. I think people are making different decisions on how they want to buy their food, and they want to know the butcher. But it's a challenge, because your butcher shop now has to be a destination. It has to be the one reason why they're going to leave a traditional format store and come specifically to you. So it's either going to be that you're just amazing, or your product is great, or hopefully both.
So I've heard a lot about, you know, slaughterhouses in different areas of the country, kind of, you know, some areas have a lot, some have a little. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, the issue of travel for the animal and how far it goes? And sort of how that plays into the larger picture of once your meat comes to the plate.
Right. Well, in the 60s and 70s, you know, consumers didn't like the product that was being presented to them. So if you think about pork back then, pork had a very heavy fat cap on it. Consumers didn't want fat. And, you know, the evolution and the sprawling of suburbia, you know, pushed people further out away from the city, and people didn't want slaughterhouses or processing or abattoir in their backyard. And then people didn't want the bones, and so they had to be more efficient, and so all that moved mainly the production into the center of the country. And why that is significant, and that's fine if you live in Kansas and, you know, you're in the middle of the country, but if these animals have to travel far, you know, think of your pet when the pet goes in the car and they're not comfortable with being in a car ride. They're stressed. They're anxious. And we want to make sure that, you know, we move animals as less distance as possible. The less they travel, the less stressed they are, and it's better on the animal, and it's also better on meat quality. So we don't want the animals to be stressed out. You know, Temple Grandin has done an amazing job with being able to change the way animals move through the transformation process. To keep them in their natural habit, you know, their natural ways, and try to keep them very calm. So we need more processing, absolutely, especially like in the New York area, any of the larger populations. And it's expensive to build up this infrastructure, but, you know, I was just out there last week at the New England Meat Conference and just bringing together, you know, processors and farmers and butchers all together to talk about how we can make, you know, a closer-knit processing system where the product doesn't have to come, you know, from the middle of the country to the coast. You know, it can be closer, and it's better on the animals, it's better on the environment. But one thing we do have to be cautious of is that just because you have a relationship with your farmer and he's bringing in a couple of beefs for you, that's not necessarily efficient either. So, you know, there's also this distribution hub that has to happen as well so that we're efficient. So the good news is it's happening. So we're definitely changing the way we want our food, and it's got to happen.
Buying meat is not always a cheap experience at the grocery store or the, the, you know, meat counter, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Give us some tips on ways that you can, you know, save some money, whether it's at the counter or at home, just tricks or tips on ways to kind of stretch what you have.
Well, the one thing is, you know, if you buy from a grocery store that features product, like advertising feature, I always tell people to look for the meat on feature, because they price meat off of markets, so sometimes there's an up market and a down market, so there'll always be a good value. So I always say to do that. If you have a grocer that, I always look for mismarked items in the discount bin, but I'm a little different because I know what I'm looking for. But, you know, for example, a whole chicken is something that I think of right away, and people get a little, you know, they're not sure how to do that, but you can get 8 to 10 pieces of servings out of a whole chicken, and then by cutting it at home, you can also use the tips of the wings and the extra fat and the back and add it to your own stock. And then you can have stock. So not only do you get 10 servings out of this whole chicken, then you also get stock that you can help use throughout the week, too. You know, if you feel comfortable, if you have the art of beef cutting and you feel comfortable buying larger pieces from your grocer or your butcher, I mean, they'll sell you a whole piece. You know, if you go into Adam DiBerio's shop, he'll sell you a whole ribeye if you want or a piece of chuck, just like the regular grocers will do. But it'll be in a Cryovac bag. And you can cut it yourself and save money, because commodity prices are going to continue to go up, and people ask me when they're going to come down. And we have a booming population, limited land resources, and unstable weather. So that's always going to make, you know, just meat and commodities go up in price. So the other thing I tell people is just eat less. You want to save money, you don't really need to eat that 12-ounce steak. 4 ounces of raw protein is a serving. And so if we can kind of get down how much that we consume, I think that'll help the pocketbook a bit too.
What do you love the most about butchering?
The transformation. I think it's grounding to me. You know, I'm very much aware that this is an animal that was sacrificed for our nourishment, and that's extremely important. And I don't like to dishonor the animal by rushing or not caring. and so it's just very grounding. It just kind of, I like to create. My mom was a sculptor and an artist, and my dad was a butcher, so I kind of feel like it's a little bit of sculpting and being an artist as well. And you know, to me it's an honor. I'm taking this and transforming it into many nutritious meals.
On your day off, are you actually eating meat?
I usually like to go out for sushi.
That sounds about right. And you know, what's on the horizon for you? What can we look forward to seeing from you?
Well, hopefully a few more books, and then my big project right now is trying to figure out putting together the Range Meat Academy here in Chicago, and that's going to be, it's no small feat. So I'm talking about a real trade school with standards, so people can come in and learn from me and other experts, and it'll be a certified program. So that's where my passion is. I really want these folks, if they're interested in the butchery trade, to understand what they're getting into, hone their skills, and understand the business side so that they can be successful.
Carrie Enderle, keep on being the badass butcher / meat cutter that you are, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This has been a blast.
You are amazing, and listeners out there, please go check her out ASAP, And as always, thanks so much to Jack Inslee, Joe Galarraga, the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Happy 75th episode.
Let's go out to eat and get some meat.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.